This is the Education Gadfly
Show. But you are
show.
More likely to have a pair of Mickey Mouse ears. Okay, I'm just saying.
You're super fudgy today.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my special guest for this week, the Charlize Theron of education reform, Lindsay Burke.
I will take that moniker.
Yeah, you like it. And also our co-host, Alyssa Schwenk.
Hey, Mike, thank you for not making me the pop culture reference this week.
Yeah. So first, I should say, Lindsay, for those of you that don't know, and if you don't know, I don't understand you. I mean, come on. Lindsay is a total rock star. She is the director of the Center for Education Policy and the Will Skillman Fellow in Education at the Heritage Foundation. Welcome again, Lindsay. And the Charlize Theron, this is in reference to the Fate and the Furious.
I believe that is the name of the movie. Don't look at me on that.
Another Fast and the Furious. Which I guess it set all kinds of records. And, you know, are we supposed to go see it, or are we just not the target demographic?
I've never seen
this particular movie.
Any of them? The last transportation related film I saw was Casablanca. So that's mine.
That's a solid transportation related.
They're planes.
But let's be clear, you did not see it back then. Fine. But that's true. Transportation related. I think the best, can we all agree, was Speed, that was the best transportation related movie?
I've never actually seen it.
You've never seen Speed? Oh,
nope.
I'm dating myself now. Come on. Sandra Bullock. I always liked Sandra Bullock. I always fell for the movie stars that were sort of the girl next door movie.
You know, I was in a movie with Sandra Bullock once, right?
What?
Yeah. Fun fact. Learn something new every day, Mike. I was 6 years old. I was living in suburban Chicago. There was a call for extras.
Wow.
And while you were sleeping, and my sister and I played her neighbor.
Wow,
that's amazing.
Yeah, it was a fun little fact. It's deleted off of any TBS broadcast. So.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah.
Okay, well, there you go. All right. Well, we're not here to just reminisce about Alyssa's childhood. We are here to talk education reform. So let's do it. It's time for the Ed Reform Update. All right. So, Lindsay, we are here in D.C., where everybody just wants to talk about ESSA all the time. But we are not talking about ESSA. We are going to talk about the other ESSA, E-S-A, Education Savings Accounts. How do you like that?
Love it. Love it a lot more than the other ESSA.
I know you do. Well, we'll leave that aside. But, hey, big news out of Arizona that the governor signed a big expansion of their education savings account program. So on this one, we have not been covering the ESA thing, I think, in a while. So help us and our listeners just understand the basics here. What does this thing do? And why is the Arizona one that got passed such a big deal? Because it's not the first.
Right. And to me, you cannot overstate what a big deal this is, right? So, I mean, Arizona kicked it off, right? So back in 2011, they said, we're going to do ESAs. We see your voucher. That's very cool, but we're going to go a little bit further. So we are going to give parents, if they want, 90% of what the state would have spent on their kid in the public system if they choose to exit. And then a parent can use that for any education-related service, product, and provider. So they can pay their private school tuition, just like they could with a voucher. Yeah. But they can do all of these other things as well, buy curriculum, hire a private tutor, do an online course if they want. So it's really a financing mechanism that enables this a la carte educational experience. So Arizona
It's like an education debit card.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And in Arizona, interestingly, they actually use a debit card option. So parents are actually getting those dollars. Yeah, literally on a debit
card.
That's right, that they carry around. So Arizona was unique because they kicked that off in 2011. Mm-hmm. But now they've just done one better by saying, you know what? Every student in Arizona will be eligible for an ESA if they want. They're going to phase it in over a four-year period. But it is effectively a near universal ESA, which is just, I think, monumental.
And the phase in meaning that everyone is eligible, but there's going to be a limited number actually given out.
Yeah, that's right.
So is this going to be first come, first serve? Is there a priority for poor kids?
How kind of. So they've done it by grade. Okay. So they are phasing it in based on, I believe it's first grade, sixth grade, and ninth grade, and then the 2017-18 year, so next year, school year. And then it will be second grade, seventh grade, and 10th grade the year after that. They'll keep doing that until it's fully universal in 2020, so K through 12. but there's a cap of about 5,500 kids on the eligibility pool. But it's open to everyone.
And no priority for the kids. Which kids can get it?
No, I don't think there's any priority built into the new expansion.
All right. Okay. So look, I have to admit, I have some skepticism here. It's funny. It's, you know, which day of the week is it? Am I the pro-school choice guy today or am I the anti-school choice guy?
It's the day that ends in Y.
I tell you, it is a little bit like that for me today, these days. But first, give me the argument. What is the argument for why we should all be so excited about this?
Well, fundamentally, this is the idea that parents are much better positioned to match learning options with their children's unique learning needs. So that's at the heart of it. And I think there's also this fundamental recognition that the assignment by zip code district-run system just hasn't produced results that have worked well for students. And so, I mean, that's the heart of any school choice argument, right? And so I think ESA specifically, there are some additional, maybe fundamental arguments in place. And that all gets back to the financing, right? Mm-hmm. Voucher models, tuition tax credit scholarships, these are great models. But at the end of the day, they kind of limit your ability in what you can do with the funding. So it's more flexible. But also, you know, there's an issue if you've got a voucher option in place, again, a great option. But, you know, do you kind of create a price floor for tuition? And so ESA's, that ability to roll over unused funds year to year to target every single dollar that's in your account, makes them so flexible and provides those additional economic incentives that are really just sort of the cherry on top.
Right. So in other words, with a voucher program or a tax credit program, in some places, the private schools have said, okay, you know, we know these parents are getting $7,000 a pop, so we are now going to set our tuition at $7,000 a pop, even if it used to be $5,000.
Right.
Because in many cases, those programs say that you're not allowed to charge parents on top.
That, unfortunately, like Louisiana, right? Yeah. So if we look at some of the programs that are heavily prescriptive, I would argue that's one of the regulations that we see. Yeah.
All right. So let me ask some tough questions here. Okay. So as listeners know, I support school choice. We do here at Fordham. And really, it's almost silly to say school choice yes or no at this point. I mean, the genie's out of the bottle. The question is, how wide should that range of choices be? And what should the conditions be on the providers, if any, in those programs? And the worry that I would have is that while lots of parents can make great choices, they are not necessarily always going to make good choices. And that at the end of all of this, let's say 10 years from now, are we really confident that kids in Arizona that participate are going to be learning more than they would have otherwise? And so if you're someone like me who cares about whether, well, you know, look, I want to see Arizona's NAEP scores go up, especially for poor kids. I want to see poor kids in Arizona complete high school, complete college, or a technical program, or climb the ladder to the middle class and believe that education is a part of that. And so because of all of that, I'm someone who believes that parent satisfaction, while important and helpful, it's not enough. It's not enough. So, you know, what if parents make choices that they find services for their kids that they enjoy, the kids enjoy, but, you know, not a lot of learning happens.
Right. So, you know, as a special gift to Mike Petrilli, the state of Arizona said, now that we have this new expansion in place, we have a near universal program, we are also going to require nationally norm reference tests to be part of the new ESA. So prior to that, they had a pretty open accountability system, right? Parents would sign a contract, any education, you know, service provider that they thought was working well for them, you know, good to go.
I would refer to that not as an open accountability system, but as a non-accountability system.
Semantics, okay. Right?
Accountability
to whom, right? I mean, look, at the end of the day, I think we'll probably always disagree with this, but I think that there's no stronger form of accountability than a parent who can directly hold a provider to account for services. And I think that they do that very well.
One important form of accountability.
Yeah. Right. And so, look, I mean, to your broader question about what about a parent who might not choose options that Mike would choose, right?
Well, not that I would choose, but that serve the public good, the public purpose of education, which is to have a well-educated citizen. Yeah.
And so I think first we've got to look at the experience that we've seen on the ground, right? So far, where we have school choice programs, generally ESAs in particular, parents are doing a really good job, not only navigating these options, but the sort of civil society response that we've seen where parents are navigating this, but they're also providing tons of information to other parents about what's worked well for them, what's actually an allowable provider. You know, I didn't like how that provider operated. Don't use them again. I mean, we're seeing this sort of Yelp-like response that parents are really generating. And I think that's an incredibly powerful form of accountability. But even if there are a few parents who maybe are choosing options that we wouldn't choose, we think that they're, you know, choosing some subpar academic options, the good options that most parents, or choices that most parents make, end up elevating outcomes for every student, right? And that does get back to sort of a theoretical idea behind school choice. But, you know, it's in the aggregate, most of those parents making pretty superb choices are going to improve outcomes for all kids.
So do you think NAEP scores in Arizona will rise?
I do.
You keep making this bet with people in Arizona.
No,
I'm just going to point out.
It's true, and I
am
already
happy
paid up
to take
with
that bet.
Right here in this studio.
Right, in this very studio.
Look, I'd be happy. Look, and I want that to happen. I mean, I want that to be. And I do think there is some reason to believe that one reason Arizona is one of those states where we're seeing some big achievement gains, that in Arizona, it's because of competition.
Yeah.
And it has become quite a great choice marketplace. Yeah. And the only question is whether this additional piece, maybe it's more of a good thing.
I mean, and I would think of the inverse,
but it also could be seen as a giveaway, especially to rich parents who don't need the money.
Okay, yeah, that's kind of my concern with the level of openness in the program. You know, we have a lot of ESAs, a lot of vouchers, started targeting specifically kids who were fundamentally not being served, whether it was because they had special needs, foster children, children who are just for some reason not getting the adequate education to which they're entitled with public dollars. Then the Arizona system, one of my big concerns is parents who could afford or are already paying for private school tuition, it's now open to them as well. And
you have to be in the public system first. Yeah. So you have to switch out.
Okay. Or look, we know from some data that, you know, upper middle class parents are spending $10,000 or more on enrichment every year, right? The after school, the summer school. So you could say, all right, this basically says that if you leave the public system, then you get some subsidies for all of that. Whereas if you stay in the public system, you don't. Now, on the other hand, you know, at the end of the day, you could say, look, we for a long time have been penalizing private school parents who have chosen to leave the system because they can't take their money.
They're paying for something they're taking nothing out
of.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you go back to that original population of eligibility, right, kids with special needs in Arizona, I mean, it's just amazing to me. I mean, if you talk to some of these parents who were really having, unfortunately, this adversarial relationship with the district where they were fighting for services that they were legally entitled to and not getting them, right? Holland Hines is a great example. She was in Michigan. They had diagnosed her son, EJ, with autism. She went to school, found him under his desk, rocking back and forth with his head between his knees. I mean, he was not being well served. And so they were about to engage in that legal battle to get services he was entitled to, decided to pick up, leave to Arizona, eventually join the ESA option. And I mean, it's amazing. She talks about how he's thriving. They have their debit card. A tutor comes over. She pays the tutor directly. They're doing a little private school on the side. They've got, you know, textbooks and online options. It's totally customized and he is thriving. And I don't know. I mean, I look at that and just think, this is, yes, we will see those NAEP scores rise, but even if we don't, the ability of those parents to find options that they know in their heart and can see day to day are working for their kids is what matters.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Lindsay Burke, she who has many titles to her name. Thank you so much for coming on, and we will be certainly watching this in the years to come.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Hey, are you a Fast and the Furious franchise fan?
I am not. Sorry.
He's been trying this out on everyone this week.
Yeah, I know. It's just like not hitting for me. Sorry.
No. Rick had some blog post about this that I can't even remember what the point of it was. But, you know, I love that about Rick. You know, he you can see him, you know, he like, okay, I'm at a movie. I have to write a blog post. I'm watching the Patriots game. Yes. I have to write a blog
post.
He
is a big TV watcher, I do believe. Spends a lot of time. Like, you would think he's writing all these books. He's got two kids now, but he watches a lot of TV. I don't get it.
Yeah.
Multitasker.
Interesting. Okay, what you got for us?
All right, we got a new study that examines a simple yet largely unexamined question. I read this study, I was like, huh, I don't think we know that. But how does school transportation relate to student absences? Like, you'd think, well, that would relate to that, right? So, hey, one of our EAPs, Michael Godfrey, decided he was going to actually see if there was a link. So it's called Linking Getting to School with Going to School.
Okay.
That makes sense.
It asks whether children who take the school bus to kindergarten have fewer absences than other kids who have other ways of getting to school. Okay, like their parents take them or something else.
It's all in traditional public schools? Provide bus transportation?
It's out of the Eccles, because, you know, he loves Eccles. So it's a nationally
Early
representative
childhood
kindergarten cohort.
Yeah.
Yep.
But all traditional public schools. I mean, these are schools that provide bus transportation, is what I'm saying.
Or can they separate out the kids that are on the bus?
He's not separating them out. He's not. Okay. I mean, it's a nationally representative.
I mean, what I'm trying to understand. I'm sorry. I'm trying to understand.
Tell us what you're really saying.
Is this about kids who are choosing not to take the bus, or is it that they don't have the option of taking the bus?
Ah, okay. Well, we don't know that by district. I mean, we know how they got to school. We just don't know how they were able to get to school.
Okay. I mean, like, some private school kids don't have
the
bus.
He did take the private schools out.
I got you. Mm-hmm. Okay. And a lot of charter school kids don't have buses. And almost everybody else does, except maybe in a few cities.
Charter schools are in here, but not private schools.
Okay, we've spent 3 minutes without even getting to the end.
I will give you all your time.
All right. Well, I'll just go with it now. But do you know what the highest, the grade that you have the most absenteeism in
kindergarten
school?
Yep, like, absolutely. Parents don't think it's important.
Elementary. I'll let you talk too, because this is a really cool study. So anyway, absenteeism is highest in kindergarten. About a quarter of all kindergartners are missing almost a month or more of school.
Wow.
Which is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
We know that absences are linked to lower test scores, higher chances of grade retention, more difficulty with social development. Like, there are gazillions of studies talking about all the bad things about missing school. Okay. Mm-hmm.
But you are more likely to have a pair of Mickey Mouse ears. Okay, I'm just saying.
Super punchy today.
It's probably true. Yeah. Anyway, I used Eccles data, class of 2010-11, nationally representative cohort of children in kindergarten in 2010-11. They collected data in the fall and the spring of the same year. Lots of surveys of teachers and parents. They test the kids. Like, these kids get all kinds of data collected on them. Okay. They use a broad array of control variables. Like, there's all this just really rich data in Eccles. So he's got things like not just race and gender and demographics, but whether the parent considered their child to be healthy. Mm-hmm. Entry level stuff in kindergarten, not only their academic entry level stuff, but their social emotional skills, how far they live from school, their attendance at before or after child daycare, whether the child lived in a two parent household. Like, it goes on and on and on. He just kind of used every control he possibly could in Eccles. Okay. Descriptively, what percentage do you think of kids take the school bus in kindergarten?
Just 70%.
15%. Whoa.
70.
I said 15.
Alyssa, you're much better. 24% took the school bus.
That's it?
Yes. The vast majority of kids get taken to school by their parents or somebody else.
Yep.
Only 8% walk.
What?
Yeah.
That's good. That doesn't sound right.
They find that children who took the school bus had fewer days absence compared with other children. They were less likely to be chronically absent, which is defined as missing more than 10 days. Bus riders were 3 percentage points less likely to be chronically absent. When controlling for variation between districts, which you got to do, kind of the results were tempered a little bit more. So bus riders had a 2 percentage point lower likelihood of being chronically absent. They saw no differences, and this is what was really strange, no differences in absenteeism by subgroup or other characteristics, including differences based on poverty level or distance to school, which I think he was really bothered by that. I mean, quote, there's no evidence that students who have lived particularly far from school were especially helped by taking the bus. He chalks it up to it's a descriptive study. It's non-causal. Mm. The measure of distance from school was really broad. He didn't think it was fine-grained enough. And so that's kind of the nugget, right? Mm-hmm. And then he talks about, the fact, again, that charter schools don't often provide transportation. I got to thinking of all these state ESSA plans that are now using chronic absenteeism. Mm-hmm. So this study sort of takes on a little bit of new life, I think. Mm. And then he says, this was kind of a lot of districts, and I don't know. You follow the news better than I do, but I guess Chicago has really slashed transportation services. And I guess it's a growing trend in some of these districts that are really strapped. So he tries to say, some of these districts should really do a cost benefit analysis, because if you've got all these kids that are getting driven to school by their parents, you might be able to approach this a little bit more, smartly.
Interesting. Yeah. Look, so, I still just can't believe that percentage is so low in terms of
too high for you.
I mean, it's too low. I mean, the percentage of kids going to
only 25% of kindergartners take a bus.
20% are going on the bus.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I believe that.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
You're taught in D.C. D.C. is not the real world.
Yes, but I also grew up in Iowa where we didn't have school buses. So we did not have a school. We had school buses to the middle school, and that was it. High schoolers were expected to drive yourselves because you got your license at 14. Huh. And elementary school students were all expected to live within either a walking zone or have parents take you to school.
Interesting.
So I'm going to guess there are plenty of cities and states that don't have a really robust school transportation system.
Well, the School Bus Drivers Association is going to make hay out of this, no doubt. And it's a good point on chronic absenteeism that they will use that as well.
And I don't know. I mean, I'll go back and look. Maybe there's something I missed. There's definitely an other category, and they're not exactly sure what that captures.
Yeah, well, and kind of getting back to the earlier point about kindergarten having the highest absentee rate. I don't think it's mandatory in 50 states, which means that in some states, they don't have, you know, people reaching out to families to get them to bring the kids to school if they've been missing 2 or 3 days the way they would in an older grade.
Well, 10 years from now, when everybody is sending their kid to school in a Google robot-driven car, then we'll see how this
impacts. Were your kids riding buses in kindergarten?
Absolutely. Yeah. Heck yeah, they love that bus.
Oh, do they? They love the big cheese? Oh, my gosh.
With all of the older kids, like, there?
Wow.
They're pretty, I think that it's pretty mild. You know, it's nice. They have the fifth graders are the patrols, and so they're supposed to keep everything
order.
But man, I mean, they do. Whew, you hear that bus coming up the road, and man, it's just like, sounds like.
But they're going to get old enough where it's just vastly embarrassing, right, to get on that thing. I mean, I know, didn't we all, like, I hit the age where I'm like, there is no way I'm taking that bus anymore.
Oh, I don't know. Mine was always like, you are dropping me off around the corner. You are not talking to my friends. And I will see you at 3 p.m.
I'll share my last bus anecdote. Mrs. Andleton was my bus driver in like 8th and 9th grade. And I got to thinking, we need to look at the relationship between tardiness and bus riders, because every time, I kid you not, every time a kid did anything, threw an airplane, was too loud, she'd pull over the bus and scream for like 15 minutes. We were late for school all the time.
That is a collective action problem right there.
Yeah, well, I mean, my sister as a senior went and egged her house. So that's just between you and us. But all of us, egg Miss Adelaide's house. We've had it with her.
Wow. Okay. So much good stuff in this week's episode. Unfortunately, though, it is all the time we've got. Thanks, Amber.
Sure.
Fun school buses. All right. Till next week.
I'm Alyssa Schwenk.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.